Hello, hello, hello. Testing.
Yep.
Hello. Where are you? Okay, let's start this morning with a word of prayer. Our Father, we thank you for the opportunity to be able to meet together and to talk about the wondrous things you have created and the information you have placed for us in your word. Please send the Holy Spirit to guide our minds this morning as we contemplate some interesting and very fruitful topics. In thy name, amen. Yeah. Okay. This is the next in our lecture series. It's on the Ten Commandments. Now, as you remember, 2 weeks ago today, we were talking about how sin came in the first place and what happened in the garden. And what we discussed was that Eve was deceived into eating the fruit because she desired an upgrade to her information system. Now, this temptation was an extremely artful one. It was masterfully executed. And it was designed to disarm her defenses and appeal to her intellect. Now notice, she was not tempted to tell an untruth or to covet something. Or she was not tempted to even pick out another god. None of these things was she tempted to do. The reason she wasn't tempted to do them is because she didn't have the circuitry in place so that they would even register as a temptation. She had to get the circuitry. She had to get the circuits lined up so that any type of this behavior would be in the slightest bit interesting to her. What she was tempted to do by the devil was to pick up some new circuitry. The temptation was to pick up new circuitry, which he sold her would make her much wiser and make her like God. So she knew she was getting an upgrade to her information system. And that's where the temptation was. After she takes the temptation and she gets the circuitry, then she can be tempted in these areas, but not before. The upgrade that Eve thought she was getting was the start of a catastrophic functional and structural change to her genome, resulting in the addition and loss of brain circuitry. Remember, we went over this in Lecture 3. Remember what it did to the neurons? Over two-thirds of the neurons have either one too many chromosomes or one too few chromosomes. That's a lot of information. These changes resulted in a predisposition to behaviors she would never have imagined before, much less acted out. Which segues right into where we're going today. These behaviors are identified in the Ten Commandments. Well, why do we have the Ten Commandments? Well, Paul tells us in Galatians 3:19, it was added because of transgression. We wouldn't have needed the Ten Commandments had there not been transgression. Why? Because human beings would not have had the circuitry to even want to do that stuff. So God would not have even have to have mentioned it. And remember, in Lecture 3, I pointed out that in Jeremiah 3, he's very clear that in the new earth, we're not going to even talk about the covenant box. What was in the covenant box? Ten Commandments. It won't even come to mind anymore. Which tells us, a little hint about next week, the whole idea of salvation is to get rid of these circuits and get the original ones back. Which means, of course, we're going to have to work in the information system and the genome, and that's what we're going to be talking about next week and the week after. What does Paul say? He says, what should we say then? Is the law sin? No, God forbid. I had not known sin but by the law. In other words, the only way I would have even known that these behaviors were a problem is if someone comes and tells me they're a problem, and that's what the law does. It tells you, you've got a problem. Because look what he says here. He says, for if I had not known lust, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. He's talking about the 10th commandment. What he's saying is, I didn't even know it was wrong to be envious of someone until the 10 commandments comes in and tells me that it's a problem. So the 10 commandments are nothing more than a diagnosis chart. We have always looked at them as being a list of do's and don'ts, as if God arbitrarily sat down and said, well, these are the 10 things I kind of want them to do. There's not really there's reasons behind some of them, but others are purely arbitrary. It's just the way I want it. And the idea is you better comply with him because he's got the power to keep you from going to living forever or not. So, you know what I mean? Humor. That's the idea that's often been spread around. These Ten Commandments don't have to make sense. Just do them. If that's what he says he wants, he calls the shots. Now, in this talk, we only have time today and barely, so you're going to find out. I've got to motor through these slides because we have an awful lot of information. We're only going to look at two of the commandments. There's two reasons why we're only going to look at two. First of all, the first reason is, as far as information theory goes, if we had to pick just two to illustrate the theory that we've been talking about now for the last, 6 or 7 weeks, it would be these two, because they're the most easy to demonstrate what we've been talking about. But there's a second reason. These commandments have been particularly targeted by the adversary, especially in the Old Testament. What are the two things that he kept coming after Israel, I should say successfully kept coming after Israel? There was two things. One was to desecrate the Sabbath, and the other one was to join these sex cults. And he was able to do it. It was a twofer, because if you join the sex cults, they always worshiped, they always met, and Sunday was their day of worship. So he would be able to get both of those, get them worshiping on a day other than the seventh day, and get them doing things which had been forbidden by the seventh commandment. So commandments 4 and 7 have been consistently under relentless attack by the other side. When they ask Willie Hutton, why do you rob banks? This was back in the 1930s. His answer was simple, because that's where the money is. So where do you think the devil is going to take his time and energy and his resources? Is he going to go where he thinks he's going to get the biggest return for investment? I think he is. He's very, very intelligent. Therefore, we're going to spend our time on these two. It doesn't mean that the other eight aren't important. And the last slide in the talk this morning will explain why all ten are actually theoretically equal. But we're going to look and see where the evil one is trying to breach the walls, because that's where we need to spend our time, because that's where he's going to try to breach the walls with you and me first. If he can get the old adage, if the camel can get his nose under the tent, the next thing you know, the camel's in the tent. Well, that's exactly the way the devil's going to work. So we're going to spend our time on these two today. Why? Well, we're going to use information theory to help us find out why he would pick these two, and what advantages they may give him in trying to make us permanently on his side. Okay, commandment number 7, you shall not commit adultery. What does Christ say? He says, whoever puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her that is put away from her husband commits adultery. This is the one, this is the definition that most churches use that still consider the Ten Commandments binding. And I remember when I was young, my father was a Seventh-day Adventist minister. He's now deceased. And there would be a problem in the church with a couple. The elders would meet, and they would have a discussion because they needed to find out who was at fault. they would actually assign elders tasks to do, to go and try to find out which one of them tripped up here. And I remember one case in particular where, after diligent study, neither one had committed their definition of adultery. It's not mine, and I'm going to try to change your definition of adultery today. So I'm going to use this word with quotes. Neither party had committed adultery. Now what are we going to do? We need to excommunicate somebody. We can't allow this type of thing to go on in our church. As if people going through a divorce aren't paying a horrific price. Have you ever seen anyone going through a divorce and going, "This is great. I'm loving every minute of it"? I call that piling on, but anyway, I'll stop there and cease and desist. Let's go back to stick to our knitting here. What do you do if you don't fit this criteria? But maybe adultery is a far-reaching definition, and we have just narrow-mindedly looked in at one aspect of it. So let's keep going. Now, what did Christ say there? If a man divorces his wife and they go out and each one of them remarry, they both committed adultery, right? Well, let's go back to Deuteronomy 24. It says, "When a man has taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes because he found some uncleanliness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorce and give it in her hand and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife." Well, wait a minute. We just read that that's not permitted. Christ said that's not permitted. And you say, well, this is Moses talking. 1 Corinthians 10:4 says Christ was the one that was leading Israel and talking to Moses the whole time out there. And Christ said so much in John 5. He says, you read Moses' writings and they talk about me. I'm the guy who gave them. So do we have a problem here? Is God being, shall we say, less than consistent? So we need to stop now, and we need to get some definitions. We need to look and let the Bible define the terms. We don't define the terms. We don't sit here this morning and try to say, well, this is what adultery is, and then try to put that definition against what the Bible says. We have to let the Bible define everything. It's its own expositor. First of all, does adultery only apply to married people? True story. About 20 years ago, my wife and I have this business, and I was going down to Mexico to see if we could get it produced cheaper down there, and we hired a guy in the United States who was very knowledgeable in dealing with the different factories right across the border in Mexico, right across from San Diego. And I went and met with him, and in our discussions, he mentioned that he was a Christian, he was born again, he was a believer, and he was glad that Connie and I were. And in fact, before we started on our first trip down to Mexico, he and I, to look at some factories, we had prayer. We got in our car. We drove to the border and drove across the border, and we're talking to the different factories, and it got late in the day, and we decided we were going to have to stop and get something to eat, and we drove into a restaurant that he knew. I, of course, was very afraid about drinking any water and all that stuff, and he says, "I know where we can go and where everything's fine." When we got in there, for the first time that day, I noticed that morning when we had started out, he had had his wedding ring on. And as we sat down to eat, he didn't have his wedding ring on. And I thought, he's lost his wedding ring. So I said to him, "Hey, you probably didn't realize this. You lost your wedding ring. What happened to it?" And he kind of smirked. He goes, "Well," he says, "you know, it's here in my pocket." And I said, "Why?" And he says, "Well, the marriage contract that I have with my wife is really only valid in the United States. when I get here into Mexico, it's not valid anymore. I don't have to abide by it. And he promptly started flirting with the señoritas who are coming by to take our order. He was playing by these rules, wasn't he? So does this just apply to married people? Because in his opinion, when he's in Mexico, he's not married anymore. I'm not so certain his wife knew all of this. Okay, if you go to Leviticus 18, Moses expands on what God said in Exodus 20. There's just, it says, thou shalt not commit adultery. We saw it in a prior slide. Moses now elaborates and he fills in what this word adultery means. Because if you look at the Hebrew word, what it really refers to is a woman should not be shall have any uncleanliness as in regards to her husband, inferring that she's gone out and had sexual intimacy with someone other than her husband. And now Moses is saying, no, no, no. And in case you guys are thinking that that's just exactly how we're defining this, we are not defining it this way. I'm now going to fill in the blanks and give you the full idea of what God is saying here. Okay, sex with, it prohibited sex with a blood relative. Well, we can understand that. We know what happens with inbreeding. You know, I won't make any comments about going down to Appalachia or anything like that. You all know what we're talking about. But it goes on. It says that you weren't to have sex with your wife's sister. And it doesn't matter whether the sister is married or not, or whether you're married or not. And it says, or her daughter. Now, you're not really related to your wife's sister, and if she's had a child with another man, there's no way that there's any genetic connections between you two, between you and her daughter. And it goes on, it says, between the daughter of your wife and another man. Suppose you marry a woman who already has a daughter. You would have really no, this genetic inbreeding problem would have no consequence in that scenario at all. So, if you go on through there, your neighbor's wife, it's the same thing. No kin genetic relationship, marriage is not an issue. He doesn't say, but if you're not married, you can do all of this. He says, you're not to do this, married or not. Bestiality, he's very clear on that here. Same-sex union, same thing again. That's clearly mentioned. And, of course, this would have, just reading a while back, where the an actress was talking about the fact that she was having an affair with another woman. And she happened to be married to an actor who was in Europe making a film. And she goes, well, it's not committing adultery because I am having a relationship with another woman, and adultery would only be defined if I were having a relationship with another man. See how we can start splitting hairs here? Here's an interesting one. People tend to ignore this, don't talk about it. But this is put right up there with bestiality. Oh my. People in the church who feel pretty smug because they haven't been practicing bestiality maybe shouldn't be quite so smug when you look at Leviticus 18. Doesn't treat them any differently. Why? Well, first of all, God didn't just say all of this because he felt like he was in, felt that morning like he was in a situation where he wanted to exercise the lawyer part of his personality and just wanted to put down a bunch of things to impress you with a lot of conditions. He was describing what was going on, not only in Canaan where they were going, but had been going on in Egypt. He had to sit down and it, actually it's a sad day that God has to sit down with his children and he has to tell them all the things I just put up there, isn't it? I'm sure it's not a conversation that either side enjoyed, but he said, you know what? In Egypt they were doing this, and in Canaan where you're going, they're doing this. And the reason I'm emptying out Canaan and putting you in is because of this. Well, you may say, well, that's just the Old Testament. People back then were, shall we say, a little quirky. We don't have to worry about that now. But if you go to Acts, look what Peter says here. He says, for it seemed good to the Holy Ghost and to us to lay on you. I should back up. The Gentile churches throughout the region where Paul had gone were writing back and they were saying, look, we're confused. Some of the Jews are coming and saying that we have to become a Jew first and then we can become a Christian. Some of the people coming here say we have to do the feast days. We have to have all of the other ceremonial services that the Jews do, and that we add Christianity on top of this. This is causing a lot of consternation in our congregation. Is that really true? And this is, the brethren met in Jerusalem, and they discussed this, and they asked the Holy Spirit, they asked God, what shall we do? And now this is the answer that they're going to be sending out with Paul when he goes out, Paul and Barnabas, or Paul and Silas, and then Barnabas is going to take Mark, and they're going to go out, and this is the message that they're going to take to those churches. They said, we have got an answer back, and this is their answer. For it seemed good to the Holy Ghost and to us to lay on you no greater burden than these necessary things. They're going to tell you, this is the kernel of what the Holy Spirit says you need, we all need to equally observe. That you abstain from meats offered to idols, and from blood, and from things strangled, and from fornication. Now the word there, the Greek word is porneia, where we get pornography from. From which, if you keep yourselves, you shall do well. Fare you well. Let's go get the definition of porneia. Illicit sexual intercourse, adultery, fornication, homosexuality, lesbianism, intercourse with animals, sexual intercourse with close relatives, sexual intercourse with a divorced man or divorced woman. This is exactly what we were talking about in Leviticus 18, wasn't it? It's no different. Same thing, same laundry list. So the requirements in the New Testament are no different than the requirements in the Old. Oh, but it just when we think we can say, ha, we finally nailed this down, we're ready to go, well, Moses raises the bar. He says, when a man has taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanliness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorce and give it in her hand and send her out of the house. And when she is departed out of the house, she may go and be another man's wife. And if the latter husband hate her and write her a bill of divorce and give it into her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband die, which took her to be his wife, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife. After that, she is defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord. And you shall not cause the land to sin, which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance. Now, wait a minute. What's he saying here? He's saying, look, a couple gets together and they get married. For whatever reason, under these rules, they're allowed to get a divorce. They get a divorce. A husband goes off and marries someone else. The wife goes off and marries someone else. And in the course of time, both of their spouses, let's say, die. And as fate would have it, the original husband and wife meet up again, and they start talking, and they go, well, we were foolish to ever get divorced in the first place. Let's get married again. Moses said, you can't do it. Now, from a Christian perspective, wouldn't we say, if God's pro-family, this would be a great ending to this rather horror scenario? Wouldn't God be looking on this and saying, I'm all for it? Finally, you have realized your problem. You're wrong, or you made a mistake. Go ahead and get married again. This will speak volumes in support of marriage. Why would God say no to this? Where he wouldn't say no if both of the husband and the original husband and wife had lost their spouses and went ahead and married somebody else. That's okay. Why would he say specifically you can't go back and marry your original spouse? Arbitrary? But arbitrary, I would say, in the wrong direction, wouldn't you? Oh, but it gets worse. Why they are no more two. This is Christ talking in Matthew 19. And what happened was, I've got to set the scenario. The priests and the rulers came up and they decided to snag him. And they told him, they said, is it okay for us to divorce or not? And Christ answers and he says, you don't understand the power of God. And he goes on to say, why they are no more two. He's talking about the two that are married. Why they are no more two but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder. We're going to come back to this again. This is very important. They say to him, why did Moses then command to give us a writing of divorce and to put her away? And he said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. This wasn't the original plan. It's because you guys are such rascals and so difficult to work with that I had instructed Moses to let this happen. This was never in the game plan. We were never going to talk about divorce. This is totally foreign to the plan. But it even goes higher. He doesn't stop here. He says, now, but let me tell you something. I want to give you something to think about. You think you've got adultery nailed? You don't. But I say to you that whoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Wait a minute. You can't even think about it? When the disciples heard this, they said, oh, who can do this? This is impossible. I wish we didn't even have marriage. This is a real problem, Christ. You can't expect us to do that. Now let's go back to Eden. Let's apply these rules and see what would have happened if we apply these rules and Adam and Eve had not sinned. Let's just go back and apply the concepts that we've got here, because we agree if Adam and Eve hadn't sinned, they wouldn't have the circuitry to even want to do something like this. But so let's go back and let's take the concepts and apply them to what would have happened in Eden. Well, first of all, Adam and Eve were movie star quality good looking. Far better looking than anyone today. They had perfect bodies. They were sharp intellectually and they were witty. They could carry on a conversation. They could mesmerize you. And they were dressed in the finest attire. And God was expecting them to go forever under those conditions and not even think about straying? Forever's a long time. Think about it. Anything that can happen will happen in a forever scenario. Today, over 50% of marriages don't make 5 years. And we're not nearly as good looking, and we don't have perfect bodies, and we're not nearly as witty, and no, we're not as well dressed, and we don't have as much accoutrements to go along with the whole package. Now, isn't this putting the bar ridiculously high on God's part? What hope do any of us have of ever complying with this requirement? And now who do we hear in the background saying, I told you so. He's made these requirements so ridiculously high, so unreasonable, he has set things up for everyone to fail, and then he can come in, as he's done to me, Lucifer, and pick you apart. He'll pick you apart just as he did for me. He's unreasonable. He's a despot. This is what I've been saying all along. Plenty of proof here, wouldn't you say? All right. Before we jump to conclusions, let's go back and let's look at things carefully now. These are serious charges. At first blush, at least, they appear to have merit. And the rib, which we're going to go back to Genesis. God had just created Adam and Eve. Now we're going to look at them. And the rib, which the Lord had taken from man, made he a woman and brought her to the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall join." That means it's really a verb, to be joined together. It's a process where you become joined together. "And he will leave his father and his mother, and they shall be one flesh." And the Hebrew word for flesh really means body. And no, this is not referring to the actual sexual act itself. There's still two bodies involved. This is referring that they're going to be one body. And this is what Christ referred to in Matthew 19 when he said, this wasn't the way it always was. This was never in the playbook to have divorce it anyway. What does he say in Malachi 2? I hate divorce. I don't want any part of it. The reason I gave it to you is because you folks are so perverse. I'll lose contact with you. This is an emergency measure. This isn't what we plan to do in heaven. And by the way, I'll give you a little hint. When he talks in Luke 20, verses 35, 36, 37 about there being no marriage in heaven, he's referring to all of these little rules we've been talking about. He's not been referring to whether men and women will remain to be men and women. Marriage is nothing more than a construct which human beings have made. We've made rules that surround this, and marriage does not just have to do with sex. It has to do with property. It has to do with children. It has to do with many other myriad of details. And I'm going to suggest to you that this is what human beings have brought to the situation, because the basic concept of a man and a woman becoming one flesh has become seriously flawed and broken. And now we've had to make rules to try to set up to do that which would not have been required before. This passage infers that the man and the woman would be so closely merged together that they would become one, together forever. Just as a rib from Adam would be a permanent part of Eve as long as she lived. In other words, after Eve got the rib and she was created, she didn't say, "Okay, Adam, here's the rib back. Thanks. It was a good starter kit. I'm on my own now." That rib remained part of her forever. And yes, that was a symbol that Adam was not to rule over her, nor she in turn was to rule over him. But there was something more I'm going to suggest to you that was something more important that we've overlooked. And that was that they were actually to be one. Christ tells the stories this way, and he said to them, we're going back to Matthew 19, where I'm now going to give you the first part of the story, and he answered and said to them, "Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female?" So God made two varieties of human beings. "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and join to his wife." The Hebrew word is cleave. This is Greek, I know that, but he's referring back to what I read to you in Genesis 2:22, and that is, the word there is cleave, and the best way to describe that is, when I was a senior in high school, I took chemistry, and part of my assignment was to write a paper on whatever topic I wanted dealing with chemistry, and I chose to write about epoxy glues because they fascinated me. And what I learned was if you take two pieces of plastic and you put the right epoxy glue on, the glue actually takes the atoms of both of the plastic tubes and marries them so close and exchanges them that where the two plastic tubes are glued together is actually the strongest part of the new piece. And if you go to try to break those plastic poles apart, the pole actually will break before the glued part will. It's now stronger than the original. It's the strongest part of this glue. The strongest part of the glued object is the glue. That's the word cleave, which if we're putting it in modern term, that's the word cleave together in Hebrew. That's what it's signifying. It means marrying together, and we use the word marry here as something other than marriage to illustrate the closeness of what they're trying to talk about. So I'm going to say to you, let's go down this vein. Maybe this is what God's talking about. He's actually talking about a physical event, not all the rules we've gotten ourselves mired in. Earlier in this talk, going through all the different scenarios that could come up. Well, we have a good illustration in science, thank goodness. There are two, voles are we can really call them, they're rodents. They're like wild mice, and we can think of them as wild mice, but let's call them by their right names. They're voles. And in the prairie areas, especially around Kansas, they've found that there's a bunch of different species of voles. And the prairie voles is what they're called. When they went in and examined them, they found that the prairie voles were very family-oriented. First of all, once a male and a female had sexual intercourse, they were bonded for life. That was it. Neither one would look on any other vole. And when they had children, they would both of them take care of the children. The pups would stay with the mom for 6 weeks. They were groomed. Father would help mother in grooming the pups and training them. They were a family unit, exemplary family unit. But then when they went a little bit, just miles away from that, and they went in, they found a new species of voles. Well, they're first cousins. I don't even know if they're species, because I think they could probably still they could still mate with each other. So they're just a different branch of the same family. They were called the montane voles, or they're sometimes called mountain voles. And these voles were completely different in their actions. They were the same in every other aspect. In other words, if I showed you a montane vole and a prairie vole, you couldn't tell the difference. But when it came to the family life, the montane voles were extremely promiscuous. A mother would have a litter of pups, and maybe, you know, two or three fathers would be involved in the pups that would come out. There was absolutely no pair bonding whatsoever. And the mother, after a week or two, showed total indifference to her pups. There was no grooming. There was no teaching them. It was kind of like, hey, dudes, you're on your own now. I've given you milk for 2 weeks. Go for it. See you around. Have a good life. Why would there be such a marked difference between two sets of voles who, for practical purposes, had come from the same ancestors, but due to geographical isolation, had been interbreeding, and the other group had been interbreeding exclusively. There would have been no interbreeding between the two, and it was due to geography. So this fascinated scientists. I wanted to show one thing here. Sorry. This is a cross-section of the brain of a prairie vole and a montane vole, and it's stained to bring out We're looking at males now because I'll explain in a moment why that's important. We're looking at the male prairie vole and the male montane vole, their cross-section of their brain. And where you see the red mark is where the vasopressin receptors are located in the brain. And this is extremely important. We're going to find out. Notice they're markedly different. The prairie vole, it's down here at toward the bottom of the screen. That is the area where the amygdala is, and that's where you have emotions. I'm pointing it out here with the pointer. That's where you have emotions, and that's very important. And for instance, I'm not going to chase this rabbit trail, but human beings, this is where we find that autism has a major, where they're finding more and more that autism, the problem of autism is centered in this area or around the area. And if you look over here to the montane vole, there's very little in the amygdala. It's all up here in the periceptal gray area where you have reinforcement. That's the reward center. That's the nucleus accumbens. That's where you, where the voles and us experience pleasure. So the where these receptors are, in essence, make up the circuitry of the brain. They help to make the flow of electrical activity in the brain, because remember 2 weeks ago we talked about, and actually 2 and 3 weeks ago we talked about G-coupled proteins and all of the effects that they have on the neurons and the way they fire and the way they communicate with one another. Well, the vasopressin receptors and the oxytocin receptors for the female, because the mirror for this in the female is the oxytocin receptor, are G-coupled proteins. And we know that those have been extensively hacked with mobile genetic elements. So there's a basic difference in the two brains of the two animals. In both the male and the female, we're just happening to look at the male this time, there's a basic difference on where these receptors are and therefore how they're going to let electrical current flow in the circuitry of the brain. And when they looked at the genetics of it, if you look at the front, there's top, there's the montane vole. Notice that there's no little red blocks. And if you see the red block down below, that is a repetitive element. That's a mobile genetic element that's nestled into the vasopressin receptor of the prairie vole. And when they did some more research, they actually found out there was two mobile genetic elements. One was a truncated line one. Remember we talked about line ones and what they've done to the brain? Remember the aneuploidy and all that stuff we talked about and the circuitry? That was in lecture three. Well, these are the guys. This is in the brain of the vole, so you'd expect these guys to be working here too in the animals, because remember, we're all mammals, and the way we respond to mobile genetic elements is in many ways the same. And what they found was that they said, I'm going to read the bottom. It says here, it says the prairie vole, vasopressin 1A receptor gene has been duplicated with one copy being downstream of a retrotransposon element. Remember, that's mobile genetic elements, another name for it. And it also has a frame shift mutation in the coding region. Both copies have a large, complex, repetitive expansion, just over 700 base pairs. As mobile genetic elements go, that's getting up there. From the transcription start site, either the gene duplication or the promoter expansion could contribute to the evolution of the expression of pattern of behavior. Now let me translate this for you. What they're saying here is they go, these mobile genetic elements, which are in the prairie male genome, have done two things. One, they've frame shifted the reading of the DNA, and the other is they've caused a second gene for the promoter of vasopressin to be made. It's called copy number variation. So instead of having one gene for the vasopressin receptor, they have two. Whereas the montane doesn't have this. It only has one, and there's no frame shift. Now, if you're thinking here, you're going to say, well, wait a minute. Mobile genetic element comes into the prairie vole and makes it behave in a way that the Bible describes we should have marriage between us occur. And I thought you said mobile genetic elements came from the other side. How could this be? Isn't this startling evidence that maybe this whole hypothesis could be wrong? And the answer is no. For me to give you a full explanation would be time-consuming, confusing, and would probably be irritating to you because it's rather heavy genetics. So I will just generalize it to say that, and I'll think it's the next screen that, oh, no, I'm going to say this and then I'm going to go to the next screen. So what they did was they took those two, they took the gene for the vasopressin receptor in the prairie vole, and they took it out of a prairie vole and they put it into a montane vole. Remember, the prairie vole is monogamous, the montane vole isn't. And guess what happened? The montane mole, who had been wildly promiscuous, now became monogamous. And they did it the other way around. They said, okay, we're going to take what happened to the prairie vole that we took this receptor out of. We'll exchange. We'll put the montane vasopressin receptor gene into the montane, from the montane vole into the prairie vole. And guess what? He became a party animal. So it is clear that it is this segment, period. Now, let's address the question, well, gee whiz, isn't this against what we have been, Dr. Webster and I have been talking about for the last 6 weeks? I'm going to read to the bottom. I'm going to go to the bottom of this. This is a paper that just came out in August of 2013, because this interested geneticists as well. It should, because here we have a clear instance where mobile genetic elements change behavior. And I could not be here today talking to you if we didn't have solid evidence that mobile genetic elements change behavior. Everything we've set up till now would be a lot of fancy genetic talk and really not worth much of anything. But here is conclusive, clear, uncontrovertible evidence that mobile genetic elements change behavior. So whatever happened at the tree of knowledge of good and evil and has continued on since then does affect your behavior and my behavior. And we're going to show you here in a moment a slide where they did the same, well, not the same experiment. We can't go into human beings and start changing their genetics. That's frowned on, and not too many people would volunteer. But they actually looked at it as best they could in human beings. You're going to find out we came up with the same answer. But reading here, it says, this is the first direct evidence that polymorphic microsatellite elements, another word for mobile genetic elements, near behaviorally relevant genes can contribute to diversity in brain gene expression profiles, providing a mechanism for generating behavioral diversity both at the individual and the species level. So that's just what I told you. Mobile genetic elements change behavior. I should put can change behavior, because there are some scenarios where even these voles will break out of the normal behavior dictated by these genes. So they're not, they don't dictate behavior, they predispose behavior. Now, number two, however, our results suggest that many features of species-specific expression patterns are mediated by elements outside the immediate 5' flanking region of the gene. Okay, now let me bring this down into English. What they're saying here is this. The two mobile genetic elements that we just saw in the prairie vole are right next to, are actually in the gene for the vasopressor receptor. But what they have discovered is that the real effect on where those vasopressin receptors go in the brain is really determined by somewhere else in the prairie vole's genome. Farther away, not near, where the actual vasopressin receptor gene is. And what has happened is these mobile genetic elements have come in and undone what another regulatory piece of DNA, most likely, almost certainly, a mobile genetic element, but they haven't identified it yet. They have undone what that other, we're going to assume is a mobile genetic element, what that other regulatory part further away in the prairie vole's genome has done, which was to shut down the monogamy pattern for the vasopressor receptor in the brain. So these mobile genetic elements are simply negating what some other mobile genetic elements had done that are further away. So it's like a negative negative. The original ones, which are in the montane, completely shut down the monogamous pattern for the vasopressin receptors. And these two wildcatting mobile genetic elements happen to settle in closer to the gene that was being affected by the original and turned off the effect that the original had. By chance. And because the two pairs hadn't been mating, the montanes and the prairies, all of the montanes, this went throughout the montane, the montanes remained, shall we say, the original. The prairies got they're not a mutation, but they got the new mobile genetic elements in, which undid what the original mobile genetic elements had done for the montanes, whereas the montanes didn't have anything to undo what the original mobile genetic elements had done, and so their vasopressin receptor pattern promoted promiscuity. The prairie did not, because one set of mobile genetic elements shut down what the other mobile genetic elements were doing, and it went back to a new default, which was monogamous. They did this in humans. Now, they couldn't do the studies exactly the same, but they did the best they could, and I'm not going to spend time today to go through it except to say that, guess what? Males have a vasopressin receptor gene, just like the voles do, and we have a mobile genetic element insertion in that gene just like the prairie voles do. And it varies in size in human beings, and they actually look to see if the longer the insertion, the more the male was more likely to be faithful to his wife. And the answer to that one was that on a correlation basis was not statistically significant, although it was present. But many other findings having to do with supplying the emotional needs of the wife, doing the sort of things that we would call bonding between a husband and wife, were much higher in certain males that had this insert than males who didn't have the insert or had only a small one, or truncated one. And I'm leaving this up here for you to look up and read for yourself. We don't have time to go through it. Now, just because you may have that insertion and it may be long doesn't mean that you will be a more nurturing husband. You can override this and you can still be a jerk. And if you don't have this, if you work real hard and you say, I'm going to go and talk with a marriage counselor and find out how to be a better husband, you can overcome your predisposition to be a jerk. It doesn't dial it in automatically, but it is a predisposition and it is inherited. And you can figure that one out, go through that in your own mind. What we're talking about here is that with the prairie voles, they describe that the male and the female become addicted to each other. After they have had sex for the first time, they become addicted. And as time goes on and they continue to live together and have pups, they become more and more addicted. And every criteria we have for addiction, these voles show, only they show it for their spouse. So I'm going to suggest to you now that originally, the original plan was a man and a woman would become addicted to each other in the Garden of Eden. And they would become so addicted to each other they wouldn't care about the others when it came to romantically inclined things. And the further time would go on, the stronger the addiction. So I'm going to suggest to you in the new earth, we will be allowed one addiction Because all sin is addiction. We're going to find out in the next couple of weeks. We are going to be allowed one addiction. And that's to your mate. And that's going to get stronger and stronger and stronger. And as eternity goes on, it's going to become tighter and tighter. Pretty good engineering now. And just I'm throwing into something here. This is very interesting. When they looked at these female prairie voles, these are the monogamous ones, they were able, by giving them sodium butyrate and triclostatin A, and you don't have to worry about what triclostatin A is. So I'm only going to look at sodium butyrate. By giving them these two chemicals, the female, when she had been primed with those chemicals, when they would show a male, she would become addicted to that male, and they hadn't even had sex yet. Okay? Now you say, so what? Well, there's a big so what here. Sodium butyrate can get into the vole system and can get into our system by the same way. Triclostatin A, forget about that. That's a chemical construct that we're not going to run into in our normal environmental. So just that's something the chemists thought up to prove this point with receptors. But the sodium butyrate is something that we run into. And sodium butyrate is made in our colon and in the colon of the vole by bacteria in the colon, which take complex polysaccharides, and as they break them down, the byproduct is sodium butyrate. What are complex polysaccharides? Plant-based food. You will not get it in any animal-based food. So think it through. What they're saying here is, in essence, what you eat will determine how predisposed you are to fulfill your part of a marriage bargain. And everyone in this room, having been exposed to or actively in the Adventist Church, how many of you have read of this in our red books? That your diet plays a very important ability in your capability of living up to what God is asking you to do. Here is a clear-cut example. That was not some third-grade woman writing Victorian ideas that she had learned from Kellogg. Only today do we understand that she is absolutely 100% right. And I could spend another hour showing you other instances where this is right. It's shockingly right. This isn't preaching salvation by diet, but it is preaching lack of salvation by diet. There's a difference there. Think about it. Now, let's go back to where it appeared that Christ made this bar unreasonably high. He says, if you even think about it, you've done it. But he also said that about anger. If you're angry with your brother and you don't make amends and you come to the altar and you meet me at the evening sacrifices, don't waste your time. You've committed murder in your heart, even though you haven't touched the guy. Same principle. We can apply this across all of them, but we're picking this one because it's very easy to demonstrate. Here's a paper. It came out in 2010 from the Harvard Business Review. And the author, Yuri Hassan, wrote a paper about a very interesting phenomenon. And I'm going to read to you what he says here, and then I'm going to explain we're going to go on for it. It says, that's precisely it. I'm generating a brain wave that generates a sound wave that generates a brain wave in you. There's nothing mystical about this. It's not a Jedi mind trick. This is what communication is. It is what humans do best, and it's unique and amazing. What he's saying is, those of you that are awake and are listening to me here this morning, an interesting phenomenon is going on. when I, in my mind, make up my sentences as they're getting ready to come out, my brain is doing a lot of work. And if you did a functional MRI of my brain right now, there's a number of different areas that would be lighting up. And new areas would be coming on board. Others would be lighting up. It's sort of like, I won't say a Christmas tree because they don't blink on and off that fast, but they do move around. And it's both hemispheres of the brain are at work, and it's a conjoint effort. At the same time, if I put you into a MRI, functional MRI, right next to me, and you're listening to me drone on, and let's pretend for a moment you're interested and you're following what I'm saying, okay? What they would find is that your MRI would mirror mine exactly. Your mind has to take the symbols that it's picking up through the eardrum, and it translates them, and in order for your brain to understand what my brain is saying, it makes the same patterns in your brain, and that's what those circuits then help you understand what I'm saying. So hence, he says, I can make your brain look like mine. And in fact, it was even more interesting. If you are if there's someone up there and they're talking to another person and they're into this conversation and they're watching this this occur, what they find is that the person who's listening can anticipate where the speaker is going, and their brain shifts to a new pattern, which the speaker's then shifts to as they're getting to that topic. You can actually anticipate where I'm going, and your brain will actually, your fMRI will look like mine a few seconds before I get there, because you're anticipating where I'm going. It even gets worse. When you have a memory, what happens with that memory is the very parts of the brain that were triggered when that memory was formed are triggered again. You, in essence, relive that memory when you bring up the memory. Now, our problem is, as we talked about, the microglia start eating up the neural circuitry that isn't used. So if you haven't used your memory for a while, it becomes defective. And you can actually train your memory. If you keep repeating to yourself a lie long enough about what happened, you'll begin to believe the lie was true, because the new circuitry will form that. So our memories are certainly not stellar. But nonetheless, when you remember something, you bring up the same neural circuitry pattern in your brain as when it occurred. You relive it. When, I got to put this in the right terminology. When a person looks at pornography and imagines what they're going to do with that pornography while watching that pornography, it's just like they're doing it. It's just like they're doing what they're imagining. The reward system in the paraceptal gray matter gets fired. Not to the extent as if they were actually involved in intimate behavior, but enough so that there is still the same release of those neurotransmitters that cause bonding. Remember I talked about in the amygdala? You're bonding with what you're on the screen. You're in that screen. You're doing it. As far as your brain's concerned, for practical purposes, not in every single aspect, but as in practical purposes, as far as the receptors that are being fired, you might as well be doing it. Christ was spot on right. Okay. Well, is this enough then to make us one flesh, one body? The answer is really no. I can make your mind look like my mind for as long as I'm talking to you, but the minute I'm quiet and sit down, your mind isn't going to look like mine anymore. And wives say to their husbands, why don't you communicate more? Well, while they're communicating, their minds are the same, but the minute they stop communicating, both of their minds go off on their different directions, and I have no dog in this fight, but I'd like to say men's minds, of course, go to more important things. And that's fine. We need women around. I'm not in any way being denigrating to them. But that's not going to make you one flesh. Now, when you go back and look at the Hebrew, this doesn't meet the standard of what they're really saying there. It's good. It's good to be addicted, all right. But we can break addictions. You can break addictions. Where's the permanent part? All right, this is something we're going to talk about more next week. So I'm just going to give you a drive-by discussion today. We'll talk about it more next week. There's something called microRNAs. These are very important. Your body has a communication system. I call it it's the tweeting of the body. Every one of the cells of your 120 trillion cells that you have in your body is constantly tweeting all the others. How else could you get 120 different cells to work together toward a common goal? You have to have massive amounts of communication. And the communication occurs through a number of routes, but this is the main one. This is the mother lode. If you want to take control of somebody, you've got to take control of the microRNA system. What is the system? What you have is a microRNA gene in the genome, and it's transcribed. A little enzyme called Drosha, it's not a little one, it's a big one, comes in and forms it into a hairpin and trims it. Sends it outside of the nucleus to where another enzyme called Dicer takes it and actually cuts it in half. As you look here at the miRNA duplex, I'll point it out with the right here. This is a duplex. This is Dicer, and it makes it into this duplex. And then Argonaut protein comes along, and it picks one of those two. And we don't know how it chooses it, but it picks one of those two, and it takes it off, and it can do all kinds of things with this new little. Well, it's not little. This new enzyme complex can do all kinds of things with that little template. It's about 19 to 23 nucleotides long, so it's very short. And it can do everything. It can start a gene, stop a gene. It can speed a gene up. It can slow it down. But the main place it really works is it takes the transcribed messenger RNA, and it can edit it. It can cut it in two. It can make it in so that it codes for a completely different protein. It can send it to a different part of the cell, to a different factory. It can do virtually anything. It's the ultimate editor. It's the ultimate editor for what's going to actually end up being protein. And when it becomes a protein, that's what actually affects behavior and makes you and me. So it's kind of like it's got the final say on what's happening, potentially. And it's reversible, meaning that it's not permanent. If you have the microRNAs go on a number principle, the more there is in the cell of a certain microRNA, the more likely that microRNAs, what it's going to dictate to the genome will happen. If there's just a small number of those microRNAs, it's less likely to happen. It's a numerical thing. And there's thousands and thousands and thousands of microRNAs in every nucleus. And they've identified at least 5,000 of them now, but they think the numbers could go on, could way up there. For sure past 10,000 and maybe even be 100,000, and we might even be short on that. There's just too many of them right now to for them to identify and catalog. And that one place they were discovered was in cow's milk, and what they found was that there was little round bodies called exosomes, and those exosomes had all of these microRNAs in it. And the little calf would drink the mom's milk. These exosomes could go through the stomach, which has very, very acidity, very low pH, and goes out into the intestine where it's picked up, taken. These exosomes are taken into the bloodstream, and they are cataloged as to where in that calf they're supposed to go, which cells, and they go to those cells, and those exosomes go into the cells, they're let in, they go into the nucleus, and they deposit their microRNAs in the nucleus, where they have a editing effect, like I just told you, on what that little calf's DNA is going to be telling the calf to do. Now, Why did I go through this? Because I wanted to show you that these exosomes are almost indestructible. I'm sure you could blow them up with an atomic bomb, but I'm saying in a daily, in the daily wear and tear, they're able to withstand all kinds of hurdles. They're going to get through from one individual to another intact, and they're going to deliver their cargo, and it's going to have an effect. Okay, well, guess what? All mammals have this. In fact, there's microRNAs in the plant life, too. It's ubiquitous. It's the common communication thread between, can be the common communication thread between everything that's got DNA. So that includes the bacteria in your gut. That includes the plants you eat. I'll give you a hint. Plant-based plants have wonderful microRNAs that are needed to help you keep healthy. You won't find them in animal-based products. You'll find microRNAs that are there to make you unhealthy. So just a little blurb on eating again. I want you to look down here at where it says seminal fluid and saliva. Notice that there is a high concentration of microRNAs in the seminal fluid, just second to breast milk. But when you look at the number of different microRNAs, the seminal fluid is right under the saliva. Those two are the have. So seminal fluid have a lot of microRNAs, and they have a lot of different microRNAs. Saliva has a lot of microRNAs, but it does not have as high a concentration of them. So seminal fluid, lots of microRNAs, high concentration. Comes from the prostate. All right, this is a busy slide, but I'm going to talk you through it because there's a bunch of very important information, so don't check out right now. We're coming for the main punch on this one. Notice down here where it says VS2, VS3, and VS1. That's vaginal secretions from three different women. And if you look at these carefully, you will notice the red means that they're... on this scale, imagine that there's all these microRNAs that they're looking for. They're all just, each one of the lines represents a microRNA, okay? It doesn't have it here because it would be far too busy and we couldn't read it all. We're looking for patterns here. We're not looking for individual ones. And you notice that in the vaginal secretions between these three women, the concentration, and if it's green, that means there's less of that microRNA than you normally expect. If it's black, that means that that's exactly the average amount that you would expect if you go across the spectrum. And red means that it's upgraded, that there's a lot more of those microRNAs than you would expect. Notice that none of the three women's vaginal secretions are the same. They're all different. Did you see that? In fact, they're talking about using microRNAs as being the ultimate forensic test, better than DNA, because remember we talked 3 weeks ago that you can have a person with two different genomes in them. Remember the rapist? They took a buccal mucosa sample and it didn't match the sample taken from the woman. And then when they checked, went back to the same culprit because they were sure he was the one, and they rechecked his sperm versus what they were able to obtain from the woman, and they matched. Remember that? I showed you Seattle paper. So you can't go by genomes anymore, but guess what you can go by? MicroRNAs. MicroRNAs are more specific for you and for me than a retinal scan or than a fingerprint. We have our own microRNA pattern that just we have. And if you look next to that, and you look under the semen, the SEs, there's three males right here. SE7, 6, and 5, notice that they're markedly different. Look at the reds and the greens. They're markedly different. You could identify each one of these gentlemen, again, by taking another sample. It would be no problem. There would be no confusing it. But it gets even more interesting. You see these MSs? That's menstrual blood taken from those three women. Notice that they, too, are different. whole blood over here for all of them was lined up over here on the right hand, on the right hand side of the screen. You'll notice it's much more homogeneous. It's more the same, but it still is different. And SA stands for saliva, and you'll notice that it's got the same pattern. So each one of these people could be identified. You can identify, for instance, that a woman is pregnant or that she's menstruating or approximately what age she is by looking at her. If we were sophisticated enough, we could look at her microRNA profile, and we could get all of that. And the same would be for a male. These are very specific. And remember what they do. They are the ultimate editor when it comes into the genome, right? And guess what else they do? They alter the synapses in the brain. And this, people, is much more permanent. It's much more permanent than me just sitting here talking to you and then you leaving and it all fades out by the time you get to that door. Gone. And if these are continually presented to the brain on a continual basis over time, it's going to change the architecture of the brain. Now, that's one flesh. Because there's massive exchanges during intimacy. Saliva, seminal fluid, and vaginal secretions. I don't have to get more detailed than that. There's massive exchanges during intimacy. And these guys go right to where they're supposed to go. They go right into the DNA of your brain. And they change the way that brain, that DNA is going to be transcribed, or they change the transcription from that DNA. They have the power to. And over time, the influence constantly being exposed to it becomes more and more permanent. They're becoming one flesh. Two bodies. But they're going to start thinking more and more alike. Doesn't mean you lose your individuality. It just means that you are moving together as a consensus into one force. Sort of like the way the Godhead works. Don't you imagine? This is a highly complex, very sensitive system. So guess what? If you start throwing in all kinds of extraneous data from different people, what do you think is going to happen to it? MicroRNAs are so important that when they look at the genome of a man and a woman, the really only difference is there's a Y chromosome for a man and there's an extra chromosome for a female, but that one of those chromosomes is going to get shut down. So really the only difference is that small Y chromosome. That's the only major difference. And that's not enough to make all of the difference that you would see between a man and a woman. And so what they have found is that these microRNAs can be directed by that little Y chromosome to say, make testosterone the main sex hormone you're going to be looking at for the rest of the body. And that's what happens. No microRNAs, no men. I know, don't start clapping, women. Because I got news for you, no microRNAs, no women. These are important. They can change the way you think, or they can at least help modulate the way you think and what you become. And these microRNAs go through all the cells in the body. So if you had a man and a woman who were consistently exchanging microRNAs in a monogamous relationship, do you see what could happen? And in a perfect environment where we don't have all these mobile genetic elements to worry about, you're going to have people that are not only addicted to each other, literally, they're also becoming one. They wouldn't want to be with anyone else because they don't think like I do and she does. What an incredible system. You don't need the marriage laws if you've got a system like this up and working. You don't need to say, well, what we need prenuptials because if we're going to break up, I need to know how much money I need to give you and who gets the car, who gets to see the children. It's not even a question. It wasn't that way at the beginning. This was made to be a permanent joining, cleaving, epoxy gluing. That's why Christ says, you guys, when he talks in Luke 20, and this is where everyone reads it, they go, well, it says in Luke 20 that Christ says, they were again bringing up the story about the woman who married seven brothers and whose wife is she going to be. And he goes, you guys, you are so far out in left field. You misunderstand how powerful God is. When they get to heaven, they aren't going to be giving in marriage and with one another, and they're going to live forever. He's saying the whole physical system is going to be entirely different. That's emphasized when he says they're going to live forever. The system's going to be different. So people say, well, they read that, and I've unfortunately heard some pontificate, people who are clearly not enamored with the idea of marriage and sex, who go, and there won't be any in heaven. I have news for them. They're in for a real bad surprise if they happen to make it there. Christ did not say there will not be males and females in heaven. He didn't say, and you'll be neutered. You won't care. He said very clearly, there's not going to be marriage. What's he talking about? Their concept of marriage, where you can hand a bill of divorce and you were free to marry somebody else. You just couldn't marry her again. I'm sorry if I have crushed some of you here today who were expecting that this was going to be removed from the kingdom. You can stay single. It's not mandatory. Last thing on this, and we're going to go away. This has a downside. This is a great system, and it's been hacked. Yeah, we need to make the marriage rules because it's been hacked. But what does Paul say? That if you join to a harlot, don't you know that you will become one flesh? This system kicks in. And he goes on to say, flee fornication. Every sin that a man does is without the body. In other words, if I look at your car and I really want your car, and I lust after your car, and I think about keying your car because you have that car and I don't, it doesn't do anything to my mind except reinforce certain circuits in my mind, but that it does do. But it really doesn't do anything against me. What he says here, but he that commits a fornication sins against his own body. When you engage in this activity, it does something very deleterious to you. And I am behind time, and Dr. Webster, rightly so, refuse to let me put any more slides in on this subject because we've got to get to the Sabbath. But I want you to go home and read Proverbs chapter 7 and chapter 8, and especially the last three verses of chapter 7, where it's very clear Solomon is talking about this young man that's being seduced by a married woman whose husband goes off on a trip, and she says, come into my bedroom. I've got everything ready. And he does it, and what he says is, this guy is being marched to the Sheol, where the dead live. She is striking him down as if a mighty warrior. Go home and read it. We don't have time to go into this today. And the evidence that here from this point on scientifically becomes very scant. But I'm going to tell you, there, if you take what the Bible says literally, which I do, this is the cause of disease. And I'm not talking sexually transmitted disease. And you can also see why, therefore, possibly having intercourse with a woman who's menstruating has, you know, people say, well, you can pass sexually transmitted diseases, the passage occurs much easily during that point of time. That's true. And people have said, well, it could be the cause of endometriosis, but actually they found women who have never had sexual intercourse who have endometriosis. So it may augment it at best, but it certainly doesn't cause it. I would like to suggest to you that it has to do with the microRNA profile that will be exchanged during that event. Now that part of the don'ts in Leviticus 18, instead of being some outdated fuddy-duddy get with the program issue, is a very important one. strange. God knew what he was talking about, and that's a shock. Okay, let's move on to the seventh. As we say, as it's said biblically, we must gird our loins and move forward. Time is going away. I'm sorry. This is the final. All of those had to do with microRNAs. I was going to go down. I don't have time. Every single one of those prohibitions would have to do with taking in microRNAs from a new source. Every one of them. So, using information theory, man and a woman meet, they become acquainted. Think of this as a pyramid. I didn't know how to make a pyramid on the slide, so just pretend there's one here. They have friendship. They get mental intimacy, physical intimacy. They're exchanging microRNAs now. They become one flesh. And then the ultimate information exchange is where the man and the woman each give part of the information for a new human being. And in the new earth and in the original Garden of Eden, I believe that if you followed, this is the way it was supposed to go. Once you hit the physical intimacy, there was no changing this union. It was together forever so that any of the children would never have divorced parents. God built it into the system that the family would be permanent. And if you got that high, if you got to the place where you were having children, divorce wasn't an option. You were addicted to each other and you'd become one. Foolproof system. Immaculately engineered. Too high of a bar? I don't think so. Can two walk together except they be believed? And then there's the admonition, don't be unequally yoked. I'll let you go home and think about this. Read what Paul says there in 2 Corinthians 6:14-16. Should the temple of God be joined with the temple of Belial? Should you be exchanging microRNAs in this manner? We haven't gotten into what happens with salvation and microRNAs, and that comes in the next couple of weeks. And you'll see this is important, so I'm just red flagging it for you now. And that's why do you think the Bible talks about our relationship with God is always put in the marriage? And that's setting the stage for next week, where we're talking about God coming in, and knowing you and me means that he's going to come in. We're going to invite him in, not unless we invite him in, and he's going to change our information system. And in the process, it's going to change our circuitry, which is going to change our thinking. Changes us. And remember when I talked to you in the first lecture, and I said to you, we talked about Matthew 7, where there are all these people on the outside, and they demand to see Christ. They say, we've cast out devils in your name. We've done all kinds of wonderful things for you, and we're on the outside, and you made a terrible mistake. And what does he say to them? Get away from me, you workers of iniquity. I never knew you. What does it say in Genesis 1 that Adam knew Eve, and they had Cain? That's our first hint to answer that little question. Well, it was a big question that I dumped on you on the first lecture. I'm not going to just leave it out there. This is one of the answers to it. The people on the outside may have been doing a lot of things, but they hadn't let him inside to actually change their code. He hadn't let them in there to actually change their code so it became like Christ's code. Christ did not know them. We're talking by the word know now, a very intricate, highly complex, and very specific information exchange that occurs between a man and a woman, if done correctly, and will occur between you and God. Okay, let's go. Now, changing term, changing scenes, we're going to the Sabbath. Remember, this was all on just one commandment, just the seventh commandment. I hope you're beginning to get the idea this is not just a bunch of do's and don'ts that God decided to sit up there in heaven and write down because he just wanted to make these people wish they'd never eaten of the fruit, and I've got a bunch of things I'm going to have them do. Let's see if they're going to jump through the hoops. Now, I, growing up, was taught that the seventh commandment was arbitrary because well, the other nine make sense and the fourth really doesn't. And my question to that was, which I asked my father and I never got an answer. Well, I said, why do we have this? He says, God has to see if you're going to be obedient to him. And I said, well, is there a problem? Aren't everyone breaking the other nine anyway? The question's a mute question. Everyone's already breaking the other nine. He doesn't need this one. He can get the answer from the other nine. Oh, but we need an arbitrary one. Well, isn't that what the devil said, that he makes rules that are arbitrary that he himself won't do? Why would he do something like that? What does it say that about a person? It's like saying, I'm going to go work for an individual, and he says, I want you to wear pink on Tuesdays. Why? Because I said so. Why? I want to see if you're going to be a good employee. Well, it has nothing to do with me being a good employee. Yes, it does. It tells me how obedient you are. Well, I could wear pink and think the world a lot of bad thoughts about you and actually be sabotaging, and I could be taking money out of the till every day. What would that prove? Well, it's just the way we do things around here. Think God works that way? You think he's going to put a rule and make it central and have it be just because I said so? Now, some of you may say, I'm going to get to that. Never mind, just wait a moment. And let's go back to Genesis 2:2-3. It says, and on the seventh day God ended his work, which he had made. So Adam and Eve just been created. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made, and God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from his work and all the things that he had made. So the Sabbath was here from the very get-go. Even if sin had not entered the world, we would still be having Sabbath. I want to make that clear. This wasn't something that was added. This is the one thing that he makes very clear. It was here from the beginning. Well, you say, well, the Ten Commandments were added because we're wrongdoing. Yes, because we wouldn't have had the circuitry not to do anything else on Sabbath. We would have been happy to have it. So you see how that goes? It's the new circuitry we have acquired from the other side that makes us want to go to Ohio football game today or whatever. Okay? Sabbath was instituted before sin. Was it a test of loyalty then? Well, wait a minute. I thought that was the role of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Sabbath was never mentioned as a loyalty issue. It doesn't mean that it can't become a loyalty issue down here, especially coming up shortly, because Eve went for the upgrade of the circuitry, and now we have circuitry that makes us want to avoid this whole situation. But it was never an issue of loyalty in the Garden of Eden. That's what the tree of knowledge of good and evil was for. So let's get our priorities and let's get this thing clearly understood before we go further. Now he says, remember the Sabbath day to cease or desist or to rest, to keep it holy. And he goes on to say, 6 days you will labor. And he makes it very clear. He doesn't even want anyone in your gates, anyone that you know, anyone that you might hire. You're not to be the cause of them not to be able to observe this day. And he couples the Sabbath with two things. He couples it in Exodus 20 with creation in the fourth commandment. And then when it's given again in Deuteronomy 5, instead of talking about creation, he talks about the deliverance from Egypt. And people who don't believe in the seventh-day Sabbath or that it's important or believe that it's only relegated to the pre-cross people say, here's proof. The basis for keeping it is a goalpost that God moves around all the time, so he can't really expect us that this rule is something that's going to last forever. He himself moves the goalposts. What is it, God? Why did you have the seventh-day Sabbath? Was it because of creation, or are you taking the Jews out of Egypt, and therefore if it's taking Jews out of Egypt, that means it's only applicable to them. Thank you. So was it a Jewish custom? No. He couples it to creation, and guess what? Creation has something to do with all of us. Now let's apply information theory like we always do when we come up to these seemingly irritating questions, and let's see what it tells us. Moreover, also I gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am the Lord that sanctifies them. So here in Ezekiel, he's saying, look, we're talking about sanctification here. This is a sign that God can sanctify you. It's a sign. It's an indication that he can really do what he says he can do. And he says, and hallow my Sabbaths, and they shall be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. And inferred in there is, I'm the creator. So Ezekiel says the same thing again. There's two reasons behind this, but I'm putting a different name tag on them now. You know, when all through the Old Testament and in the New, when they talk about Egypt, the Israelites being brought out of Egypt, that it is a prototype of salvation, because it's us leaving the slavery of sin and going to the promised land. And so what God is saying here is, there's something about the Sabbath which you need to know that directly impacts on my ability to, number one, prove I'm your creator, and number two, prove that I can do the salvation issue that we're going to be talking about in the next couple of weeks. I can take all of this mobile genetic elements that the evil one has been able to take two-thirds of our information system and infiltrate, and I can rewrite it. We need to know this. This is important. Because if he can't do that, I don't care if he's a creator, if he can't rewrite things, we're wasting our time. We should go to the Ohio football game today. We should all go up there and tailgate right now. And this is from Romans, and this is going to tell us something very important. And he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of righteousness. What he's saying here, this is Hebrew parallelism, that a sign and a seal are, you can interchange them. Sign equals seal. What is a seal? It gives you the name of the person who's, in biblical times, if a king made a decree, what would happen is they would bring in the decree and they would put some hot wax at the bottom of the decree, and the king had a ring, and he would take that ring and he would imprint it on the wax. Remember when Joseph became the Pharaoh's right-hand man, he got to carry a ring? That means he got to make all the rules. Pharaoh was saying, you make all the rules. Only in the actual title am I higher than you. As far as everything else, you're just like Pharaoh. And as a sign of that, here's my ring. You can now use my ring and make any rule you want. Go for it. And in that, they would give the name of the person who's validating the decree, their title, and what territory is affected by it. So if the Sabbath were a sign and a seal, we go back to the fourth commandment, and we're told there that God names himself, and the reason that he has this title is because he created us, or brought us out of Egypt, and the territory is the whole world. So we know a little hint right now that the fourth commandment validates the other nine. Without the fourth, you really don't need to keep the other nine. There's no legal reason why you need to, using earthly terms. In what way is the Sabbath a seal? Why do we need one? Why even bother with this? Can't God come down like he did on Sinai? Earthquake, fire, rocks rending off the mountain. Wouldn't that be a proof enough? Except there's a problem with that approach. 40 days later, everyone who was quaking in their boots were running around, including Aaron, dancing in front of a golden calf. So it really doesn't last very long. That type of proof isn't really convincing. It scares people at the time. It scares them spitless. But a couple days later, they go, oh, well, it wasn't that bad. And pretty soon they forgot about it. So we need something intellectually here. We need something that's, we can sink our teeth into. pyrotechnic techniques only last so long. Well, what they went is they, this was interesting. It was back in the 1980s. They started looking at twins, and they and not only twins, identical twins, monozygotic twins, and dizygotic twins, which mean not identical twins. And they also just started looking at these twins that would be put into a neonatal intensive care unit. Now, why is that important? Well, you may not know this, but when a mother is going to deliver some premature babies, they ship her to a center that's got a neonatal intensive care unit, and they have a delivery room that's right next to the neonatal intensive care center, and there's a unit, and there's actually a window there that as soon as the babies are born, they're handed right through the window and into the NICU, and they're taken over to a bassinet, and they're put into the bassinet, they're dried off, and they put monitors on them, and they do all kinds of fancy things. They may have to intubate them, do a number of things. So that little baby never gets exposed to anything but the NICU, neonatal intensive care unit, where they can try to keep the number of bacteria, especially the pathogenic ones, down and all kinds of other things. And the baby is then put under what we call billy lights, which are special lights that have a wavelength that triggers the skin and the body to break down bilirubin. Why is that important? Because if bilirubin climbs way up higher, 19-20 range, you can get something called kernicterus, which is where the brain is actually affected adversely, and it's permanent and cause cognitive difficulties. So they put them under these billy lights so that the bilirubin will aid the body in breaking down the bilirubin so it doesn't build up to dangerously high levels and get into the brain where it can cause damage. And so then they put little, it's funny, they put little either pads and tape the eyes shut, or they put these little sunglasses on the babies. So the babies, the temperature is the same 24/7. The people taking care of the baby all are wearing these special gowns, and if mom and dad come in and visit, they've got to put on the special gowns too. And the babies can't see the clock, but even if they could, they can't see it because they've got these, the bright lights are shining down on them and they're wearing shades. So they have no way of, they have no external clues whatsoever from their environment as to what day it is, what time it is. They have no way of anchoring anything in, from the outside with themselves. So chronologically speaking, they're adrift. And what they found was, is that first of all, when they would get blood gases, they noticed that there was a pattern that when every 7 days, the pH in the baby changed on a cycle that was a weekly cycle. And now, do you see the squiggly lines? We have something called a circadian rhythm, which is a 24-hour rhythm. And you know if you get jet lag, that's a circadian rhythm that's been screwed up. And what happens with the circadian rhythm, for instance, in the liver cells, for the 12 hours of the day that you're awake and out working, the liver cells are all geared to take glucose in from the blood because you're eating a couple of meals at least during the day, and they make it into glycogen. At night, when you're sleeping, your brain needs that glucose to stay alive, and so what happens is the liver cells actually break down all the machinery that makes the glycogen, and they build new machinery that breaks down the glycogen so they can put the glucose back into the bloodstream during the night so your glucose levels don't fall. And it's a massive procedure, and it's done every 12 hours. And that's why you just don't feel right when you go over to France. It takes a couple of days for this machinery to catch up with the new time. It takes about an hour per day. But that's called the circadian rhythm. What they find in these neonates is that the circadian rhythm is there, but it's not nearly as prominent as the circa septa rhythm, which is the 7-day rhythm. The 7-day rhythm is the predominant rhythm, and it's felt to be the rhythm that sets up the circadian and helps to set up the lunar, which is the 28-day cycle. So human beings run on 3. 24-hour, 7-day, 28-day. The most important of the 3, 7-day. It sets the clocks for the other 2. Not only is that, but they also notice blood pressure and heart rate, and I don't have one here to show you temperature. All the metabolic functions of the baby are on a 7-day cycle. And there's no way these babies have a hint. They're not reading the Dayton News, and they say, oh, it's Tuesday. I'm supposed to have a slightly higher fast heart rate today. Let's move things up. And my temperature needs to be a little bit higher, and my BMR needs to go up. And they have no way of knowing. They just came out of mom. They've had no external cues whatsoever. This is innate. They came equipped with this. There's no other explanation for it. And scientists who have no dog in this fight are the big promoters of it. They're going, wow, we found something here. Now, this slide, we need to take just a moment on. This is sudden infant death syndrome. You've heard of that, haven't you, SIDS? It especially hits children in the first year of life. It's terrible. When you hear about a family that's been hit by it, it just puts a stake through your heart. Children suddenly die for reasons that are not known. Lots of ideas of why, but no one knows for sure. Notice none of the other, when I put up blood pressure, pulse, and blood pH, which is a blood pH is a very good indication of the metabolic state of the body at the time. So that's why I forgot to mention that on that slide. That tells you a lot. That says that this isn't just some fanciful, not much that fanciful data that's not really that important. It's very important. None of those had a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday on them, did they? They didn't. They didn't record that. They just recorded the seven-day cycle. This one does. This paper has a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and guess what? The incidence is highest on Saturday by far. Second highest on Sunday. See that? And they said, well, maybe it's because these infants are out of the NICU, they're at home, and they're reading the paper. Or they're seeing mom and dad are home on Saturday, and they think this is the day for SIDS. There is external clues here. So they went back, and they looked at the data, and they looked at it, for instance, when Christmas comes on a Tuesday, and they said, well, will we see an increase in SIDS that day because mom and dad were home? And they were able to determine this was a special day. And guess what? No difference. No difference at all. So the external cues here on SIDS have been ruled out because they did very good statistical analysis. That's not an answer here. Something is changing physiologically. And I'm going to suggest to you that possibly what's changing physiologically is that there is a downregulation on Saturday of all of the important body functions. Because how else would these children be the most susceptible, for whatever causes it, to perturb the situation so that they die? It is yet to be established by many more data than are now available whether in the early life of organisms as different as crayfish, rats, pigs, and human beings, the circumceptans are a universal design feature. Did you get that? It's in everything they've looked at, and they think it's even in plants. It appears anything that's got DNA has got this seven-day cycle. Now, they haven't looked at a lot of plants, and they've looked at crayfish, they've looked at rats and pigs, and they've got this same seven-day cycle. And they say here, it's on several other species, suggests that this may be so, that it may be everywhere. Circumceptans may be an expression of an internal integrative adaptation of the need to lock in with some intermediate frequency for phenomenon of growth and regeneration. I'm going to say that again. Growth and regeneration. This is talking about a seven-day cycle that your body has to go through in order to keep growing and to stop and fix things up so that the growing doesn't become jeopardized because you're so busy growing that you don't go back and do the proper housekeeping on what's already been made. Cancer doesn't do that. Cancer keeps growing, and it doesn't stop and go back and repair the cells that might be damaged. And you see what happens with cancer. So this is very important that we undergo the regeneration and repair. And that this process cannot be completed within a day, but did not need a month for completion. It seems possible in view of the evidence thus far that circumceptans in evolution preceded circadians. I told you it came first. And it is important to know that they have a geophysical near match with a period of 6.75 days in the geomagnetic disturbance. This harmonic of the rotation of the sun around its axis, apart from any other lunar influence, may be particularly important for forms of life developed, perhaps at the bottom of the sea or even in the Earth's interior, away from the 24-hour alternation of light and darkness at the surface. What they're saying here is for organisms that are deprived of knowing when the sun comes up and when the sun comes down, which is how our circadian rhythm through the pineal gland sets its clock too, that these animals that are in the bottom of the ocean that have never seen the light of day, literally, are on a seven-day cycle. They have to be, or they don't thrive. Something is sending a signal that's not having to do with the light of the sun, and they're looking. I will tell you right now, they've looked at a number of things. They've looked at geomagnetic. They've looked at the different interactions between the planets and. Right here, they were looking at the sun as it goes on as it's turning on a 28 to 31 day cycle. It has a wobble, and maybe that's what it is because there's a 7 day feature to that. They're looking around, and if you say, well, wait a minute, this says 6.75 days. Actually, when they looked at humans, we're about 6.9 days, and someone would say, well, that doesn't have anything to do with Sabbath because after 20 or 30 years, you'd be off a day. Or after 100 years, you'd be off a day. Remember, we've been hacked. What other system that was originally there has been hacked? It's remarkable that we're at 6.9 days and that the animals, the one-cell organisms, are at 6.75. What originally coded for this has been messed with. The harmonic of the, I read that. About a 7 day circumceptan component found at different levels of organization, notably in relationship to growth, regeneration, repair, and development. Your body cannot go at 100% pedal to the metal constantly. It can't do that. It's going to wear out the gears. So what has been set in is there's a 7 day cycle where the body pulls back, takes a collective breath, goes around and looks at all of the cells. Some of them may need some repair. And it says, this is a honey-do list today. We're going to go back and we're going to take care of the things in the house that need to be taken care of before we get ready to go back to work next week. And if you don't do it, it's at your detriment. I'm just going to throw something out there. Isaiah 58. If you keep my Sabbath, you will be the head. Jeremiah 17, you won't borrow. You will always lend. All the kings of the earth will come into your city. You won't go into theirs. Why? They're not doing this. Here at the bottom, lending additional support for the endogenicity of circumceptans, like circadians, about weekly features in environmental variables such as geomagnetic pulsations were genetically acquired. What they did is they put a receptor down in Antarctica, which was way out there in the middle of nowhere, and they measured what, and I want to go into this, the geomagnetic fluctuations, which are about 6.75 to 6.85 days in length. And they correlated it with our circumceptans, and they said maybe that's where we're getting it from. Correlates right on. This finding leads further to support the proposition that the circumceptan system, like the circadian system, is genetically anchored. It's in the code. Of particular interest is the result relative to body weight. We weren't going to go into that. Jumping down, it says, which shows the strongest evidence for a genetically determined circumceptan system in keeping with the earlier observation that the circumceptan component is particularly prominent Here we go again. Growth, regeneration, and repair. You can't go, you go 7 days pedal to the metal. Your body is going to try to rest as this cycle goes. And I would suggest to you it's on the seventh day. Notice what we saw with SIDS. Okay, I'm going to show you a video, and I want you to listen to this video very carefully. There's a lot of information, so I'm going to help you before you watch it, and I'm going to tell you what you need to key in on. Greg Vintner is the one who was credited, along with Francis Collins, of mapping the human genome. They came out together in 2003. Actually, they came out prematurely. They hadn't really done it all yet, and they're finding that a lot of those early maps aren't as accurate as they'd hoped, but nonetheless, that's what they did. He is very well known because he is working in the genetic, he's trying to make bacteria that will make oil, okay, or make energy. That's where he's going, and he's a very smart man and knows a lot about genetics. And he held a press conference a couple of years ago where he said, everyone said he created life. Well, no, he didn't create life. What he did is he went to bacteria B and he took their genome and he completely got all of the, he mapped it. About a million base pairs. And then he went out to his laboratory and he got those base pairs and he put them together. And he remade the genome. And then he took that genome that he had remade and he went to bacteria A and he sucked the DNA out and he put his engineered DNA in to bacteria A. Now, bacteria A is different than bacteria B. He took the genome and he copied the bacteria B genome and he put it into bacteria A after removing the genome from bacteria A. And a couple of days later, bacteria A started turning into bacteria B. Okay? So he didn't create life. All he did was he showed that DNA is the main component of what causes us to be what we are. He's going to talk about that at the beginning. Listen to it. It's interesting. But I want you to listen to what he's going to tell you at the end. Because he's going to address a very important question. How do you know he didn't just go to bacteria B, suck up the DNA, not do anything to it, come over to bacteria A after he'd removed its DNA and put the new bacteria B DNA in? He hadn't made a thing, but he's going to claim he did. He's going to address to you how he can prove that that's not the case.
And we thought this would be a great test bed for learning how to get chromosomes out of yeast and transplant them. When we did these experiments, though, we could get the chromosome out of yeast, but it wouldn't transplant and boot up a cell. That little issue took the team 2 years to solve. It turns out the DNA in the bacterial cell was actually methylated, and the methylation protects it from the restriction enzyme from digesting the DNA. So what we found is if we took the chromosome out of yeast and methylated it, we could then transplant it. Further advances came when the team removed the restriction enzyme genes from the recipient Capricolum cell. And once we've done that, now we can take naked DNA out of yeast and transplant it. So last fall, when we published the results of that work in Science, we all became overconfident and were sure we were only a few weeks away from being able to now boot up a chromosome out of yeast. Because of the problems with a Mycoplasma genitalium and its slow growth, about a year and a half ago, we decided to synthesize the much larger chromosome, the mycoides chromosome, knowing that we had the biology worked out on that for transplantation. And Dan led the team for the synthesis of this over 1 million base pair chromosome. But it turned out it wasn't going to be as simple in the end, and it sent us back 3 months because we had one error out of over 1 million base pairs in that sequence. So the team developed new debugging software where we could test each synthetic fragment to see if it would grow in a background of a wild-type DNA. And we found that 10 out of the 1,100,000 base pair pieces we synthesized were completely accurate and compatible with a life-forming sequence. We narrowed it down to one fragment. We sequenced it and found just one base pair had been deleted in an essential gene. So accuracy is essential. There's parts of the genome where it cannot tolerate even a single error. And then there's parts of the genome where we can put in large blocks of DNA, as we did with the watermarks, and it can tolerate all kinds of errors. So it took about 3 months to find that error and repair it. And then early one morning at 6 a.m., we got a text from Dan saying that now the first blue colonies existed. So it's been a long route to get here, 15 years from the beginning. We felt one of the tenets of this field was to make absolutely certain we could distinguish synthetic DNA from natural DNA. Early on, when you're working in a new area of science, you have to think about all the pitfalls and things that could lead you to believe that you had done something when you hadn't, and even worse, leading others to believe it. So we thought the worst problem would be a single molecule contamination of the native chromosome, leading us to believe that we actually had created a synthetic cell when it would have been just a contaminant. So early on, we developed the notion of putting in watermarks in the DNA to absolutely make clear that the DNA was synthetic. In the first chromosome we built in 2008, the 500,000 base pair one, we simply assigned the names of the authors of the chromosome into the genetic code. But it was using just amino acid single letter translations, which leaves out certain letters of the alphabet. So the team actually developed a new code within the code within the code. So it's a new code for interpreting and writing messages in DNA. Now, mathematicians have been hiding and writing messages in the genetic code for a long time, but it's clear they were mathematicians and not biologists, because if you write long messages with the code that the mathematicians developed, it would more than likely lead to new proteins being synthesized with unknown functions. So the code that Mike Montague and the team developed actually puts frequent stop codon, so it's a different alphabet, but allows us to use the entire English alphabet with punctuation and numbers. So there's four major watermarks all over 1,000 base pairs of genetic code. The first one actually contains within it this code for interpreting the rest of the genetic code. So in the remaining information in the watermarks contain the names of, I think it's 46 different authors and key contributors to getting the project to this stage. And we also built in a website address so that if somebody decodes the code within the code within the code, they can send an email to that address. So it's clearly distinguishable from any other species, having 46 names in it, its own web address, and we added three quotations. With the first genome, we were criticized for not trying to say something more profound than just signing the work. So we won't give the rest of the code, but we will give the three quotations. So the first is to live, to err, to fall, to triumph, and to recreate life out of life. It's a James Joyce quote. The second quotation is see things not as they are, but as they might be. So it's a quote from the American Prometheus book on Robert Oppenheimer. And the last one is a Richard Feynman quote, what I cannot build, I cannot understand. So we tried to build a little bit of, because this is as much of a philosophical advance as a technical advance in science, we tried to deal with both the philosophical and the technical side.
It forever puts the question of whether or not God is the creator out of the question. Because he has put that seven-day cycle in the DNA, and he called it ahead of time. He called it when? Creation week. He says, this is how you're going to know that I'm the creator. I'm putting a seven-day cycle in. And I'm having it triggered by all kinds of things that are beyond anyone's scope of being able to do but me. Now, why is that important? Well, because if he isn't the guy writing the code, I really don't care what he says on the other nine. He's not the chief honcho, and I say that respectfully. He's not the main person. The person writing code is the one we need to be zeroed in on, and we need to avoid anyone else. Now, could it be that the genetically programmed seven-day cycle would affect brain function? Might the seven-day be part of a circa septan rhythm when brain physiology is most receptive to downloads from the Creator and the body be in physiological recharging mode, restive, in preparation for the week ahead? So in other words, God's saying, we're going to have to put a seven-day cycle in so that this machinery can last forever. And that 7 days, we need to stop it toward the end of that seven-day cycle and do a honey-do list to make sure all the cells are functioning well. And during that time, when things are going to be a little slow metabolically for you, what if we make the brain perfectly best suited for downloads, communication between you and me? So while you're resting and you're not being distracted with your work because we need to do the body restoration part, let you and I have a conversation. Let me give you the downloads you are going to need so that you're always going to be, you and I are always going to know each other. You can't know someone, you can't know your wife if you never talk to her and you're never at home. That goes to the seventh commandment that we were talking about. You need time for relationships. The idea that autism is a static encephalopathy is being challenged by evidence that autism can remit. Some autistic children, for example, get a lot better when they have a fever. They make eye contact or even talk, which they had not been doing otherwise. What this is saying is the metabolic condition of the brain greatly affects what it can and can't do. And in these autistic kids, if they develop a fever, they lose some of their characteristics of autism. Therefore, those changes that I was showing to you earlier do make an effect on brain function, or at least the suggestion is highly suggestive that they do. And guess what? For those of you, I remember when I was young and someone told me that there was going to be Sabbath in the new earth, I went, oh no! I've put up with it down here. We're going to have it up there forever? You've got to be kidding me. That's back when, bless their hearts, my parents were still rooted in the idea of what you could or couldn't do on Sabbath, and that became a major source of mental anguish to those of us in the younger sets, always wondering if maybe there was something we had just done that was that would fall into the doing wrong category. Too bad. The devil's been so effective in camouflaging this exquisite opportunity. Do you realize how many of the heavenly beings would give their eye teeth to get a chance to meet with the Creator one-on-one? They have to wait. We're told in Hebrews that we get to go, in Hebrews 4, we get to go to the front of the line. We don't have to wait. And in fact, he says, I'm going to set a date with you every 7 days while your body is regenerating. That's what you should be doing regardless. Let's meet. And I'm going to carve out time for you. God didn't quit working on the seventh day, or else we wouldn't have gravity. We wouldn't be here. He curtailed some of his activities. He says, I'm going to take my daily planner and I'm going to mark out time for you. I'm going to cut down on some of the other things I'm doing so I can meet with you And we go, oh, come on. I need to do the grocery shopping. If you showed up to date your wife and you walked in the first time you dated her and you show up at 6 o'clock and she's out in front of her condominium and she's weeding and you go, hey, wait a minute, I thought we had a date. I know, but I just thought I'd take care of these weeds. I hope that this isn't a problem. We can talk here while I'm weeding. We're going out to dinner. I'm going to a play. Let me just get this weeding done, and I have to do a few dishes. But come on in, we can talk. We're going to miss the meal and the play, but I've got to get these things done. I'm sorry. This week's been a bad week, and I'm trying to catch up. How long would you date her? What chance does this have to going on to what we were talking about earlier? Zero. What chance do you have of becoming so God can say, I knew you, if you're doing that? Zero. This is the most important of all the commandments. Because if this one isn't true, the other 9 don't really amount to a hill of beans. Of all of them, it's the least arbitrary. Because it gives force to all of the others. Why do you think the devil's going after number 4 so hard? And why do you think maybe something's going to happen here at the end of time? When it's especially important that God's people get downloads, that on that weekly cycle they are there because they have a work to do that no one's ever been asked to do before, do you think that that might be of vital importance? And do you think, therefore, the devil would go out of his way to make sure that doesn't happen with laws and things like that? And if you don't do it, you aren't going to make it through? Does that sound arbitrary to you? He's giving you programming for what's coming, and what's coming is very bad. And if you're not sitting around to getting it, and I've heard people say, well, it doesn't fit into my schedule because, I've got, God's omnipotent. He can meet me on my schedule. Well, guess what? If on Monday I said to you I was going to give each one of you $100,000, you had to be out in front of here. This is just an illustration. And you had to be out in front here on Monday morning at 10 o'clock to get the $100,000. And I had a Brinks truck all arranged to come, and the Brinks truck come, and half of you showed up. You got the $100,000, and then 2 days later, I started getting phone calls from the rest of you, and you're irate, and you said, where's my $100,000? I said, well, were you there on Monday? No, but it wasn't convenient. I thought I'd like to show up on Tuesday or Wednesday. You've got the money. You're all powerful when it comes to this money. Just give it to me on Tuesday or Wednesday. I said, no, I can't do that. Because I had the Brinks truck all set up to deliver it. You missed out. You don't get it. So is God being arbitrary when he says, he makes it very clear, I'm going to back the Brinks truck up every seventh day? Do you and I have a right to say, oh no, we want it on Sunday. We want it on Friday. He's telling you very clearly, the Brinks truck comes one day, Saturday. Here's the last point. Mercifully, I know we're way over. I knew we'd have trouble today. Despite my best efforts, I failed. We're over time. Here's this statement. If you've broken one, you've broken them all in James. And I've heard pastors go through mental gyrations trying to show you how if you break one of them, you've really broken all the other 9. And I have to tell you, I give them an A for effort, but an F for content. It doesn't work. You can't make that argument. But you can if you're working with information theory. Because you see, if you have one of these areas that you are still using the circuitry from the other side, therefore you're utilizing the mobile genetic elements and they're growing, guess what's going to happen? If it's not eradicated, you know what they're going to do? They're going to multiply and they're going to spread. And they're going to go to the other areas where they've been shut down, and you're going to start getting that circuitry kicked into order, and pretty soon you're going to be doing all 10 of them. You have to get rid of all the mobile genetic elements. If you don't, you're not safe. They'll reappear. So that statement is definitely true. Okay, we're done. Let's finish with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for the wonderful law that you gave us. And Psalms 119 tells us how wonderful it is and how we should be contemplating it, because guess what? That's where the seeds, that's where the reality, that's where the information we need to support life. May we approach you and your law much differently now, we pray. Amen.